compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Sunday morning. No, Thursday morning. What am I saying? Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. 888-914-9149. As per usual, we have people already lining up out the door before the show even started, but there are a couple of lines open. So trust me on this one. If you want to get on the air quickly, I would call now, 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Hello, Cyrus. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good morning.
Let's do it. Let's go to Christine straight away. Let's go to the phone, Sarasota, Florida, to talk to Christine. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning, Patrick. I am a single mom. I have a son and a daughter. Okay. My son recently got married to a woman that, you know, I'll be honest, we were a little worried because mm-hmm. she, even before they got married, didn't seem very interested in having anything to do with his family. And seemed to have a lot of anger issues. She was always ready to fight with somebody, fighting with people at work. And just, you know, so we were concerned because, of course, it's every mother's nightmare that they're not going to get along with their children's yeah. spouse. But unfortunately, we were right. And shortly after they were married, she has decided she wants nothing to do with his side of the family, which is a little odd because that's the same thing her mother did. Her mother pretty much cut her husband's mother out of their lives, and she grew up without really knowing her grandmother other than what the family had to say about her. So at this point, we're not invited to their house, not that we ever really were anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't really hear much from my son. Sometimes he will answer a phone call. Most of the times he does not. Mm-hmm. But he will show up on a holiday, you know, maybe with some flowers.
Well,
I feel like it's just out of duty.
That's something.
It is a plus.
Yeah.
It is something. But I'm trying. I know you're not a family therapist, but I am. I just fluctuate from heartbreak to anger.
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice. How old are these two?
They're early and mid 20s.
Okay. And how long have they been married? And do they have any children yet?
They don't have any children. They were, they've been married, like 5 months. They've been married 5 months. They did not get, now this girl was supposedly such an extreme devout Catholic, made it clear to my son that he was, you know, that this was how they were going to raise their children, which was fine because I recently went back to the Catholic Church. So I was very happy about that.
Yeah.
She's been here, and unfortunately, they did live together before they got married. So that was the excuse for not going to church.
Mm-hmm.
But they have still have not gone to a church because she cannot find a church that is up to her standards.
But they're married civilly. I take it they didn't get married in a church. Is that right?
They did not get married in a church. They got married outside with, a Methodist minister.
Okay. So let's start there. So they're living in an invalid marriage. That's the first thing. Two baptized Catholics who have received their sacraments. And that's not on you. That's not a reflection on you or your husband, Christine. Oh, you mentioned you're a single mom. Okay, so that's not a reflection on you.
By myself.
Mm-hmm. But objectively speaking, they're living in an invalid marriage. So we can start with that little bit of information. There are no children. And I suppose, I mean, it's always a blessing to have children, but under the circumstances, it decomplicates things, at least for you as...
Sure.
You know, if you had grandchildren that you were pining away to see, that would complicate things further. So at least we don't have that level of complication.
Oh, yeah.
Here is my reaction to this. First of all, I have seen this before, and I understand how painful it is and how maddening and baffling and just bewildering it is that somebody would do something like that. I can understand your sense of all of those things. My advice would be take the long view. First of all, these are young people. They don't really know a whole lot. They don't certainly don't know a whole lot about life, as evidenced by some of the dumb mistakes that they've been making. So my advice would be offer up your anguish to the Lord, offer up your bafflement and all those feelings that alternate between anger and sadness and everything in between. They're normal human emotions. Offer those up to the Lord, and that will be good for you because it will help to purify you and deepen your own faith in God's providence, because we like to fix things ourselves, and we like to, you know, find the app for that so we can fix the problem. And sometimes in life, you can't. And it's an invitation. I know it doesn't sound like, oh, gee, great, what an invitation. But this really can be for you an invitation to become an even deeper, more mature, and holier Christian. Because it's an invitation for you to, as the old saying goes, let go and let God. In other words, if this is something beyond your control, allow God to just work in this situation however long it may take. Now, I know that sounds like, oh, that's easier said than done, and it is, but it can be done. So that'd be my first thought. Second thought would be, these things have a way of working themselves out. Now, if she's this domineering, and this my way or the highway, I don't get the impression that he's going to be willing to put up with that indefinitely. And this could work itself out in that regard. They're already in an invalid marriage. Ideally, if they could get back on track and get their marriage blessed and be happily ever after as a Catholic couple, that would be great. But it may not work out that way. And she may wind up driving him crazy. And then you see how things unfold. So take the long view. You can afford to. You know, there's no pressing urgency at the moment that, you know, would require that you see them more often. And here's the third thing. The third thing would be to not empower her. And listen to this for a second, okay? Don't empower her by pursuing them. Don't pursue them. Don't text him. Don't call him. Don't visit him. Just go. In essence, you're going to be passive in this regard. The more you text and you don't get an answer, and the more you call and you don't get an answer, and you email and you don't get an answer, and, hey, we'd like to get together, and I'm sorry, the more you empower her, because she's got power over you and you're dancing to her tune. So just decline to do that. And here's what I think will happen. Your son, at the very least, is going to say, whoa, what's up with mom? You know, she stopped communicating with us. Right. That is going to now throw the power dynamic in your direction, because then you're the one who's setting the tone. You're not reacting to them. You are setting the pace. And then eventually, almost certainly, he will start reacting to you. Hey, mom, everything okay? I haven't heard from you in a while. He'll start texting you. Now, this could take weeks or months. I mean, who knows? But the more you pursue them, I can tell you this much. The more you pursue them, the more powerful their power dynamic will be in this situation over you.
Right.
So just decline to do that and go silent. And when you see them, smile. And if they, you know, call you, be cheerful and don't be angry and don't be any of those things. But let them see that it's not bothering you. And maybe part of the psychodrama here is that this girl thinks that she can, you know, run you around or punish you or do something. Who knows what it might be. But don't let her have that. And the more you starve the oxygen out of that room, the less of a problem it becomes. And the more likely it is that your son, at the very least, is going to start trying to pursue you, which is what you want.
Right. Okay.
Now, those are the bits of advice from a non-family therapist. I'm not a therapist. I don't have the training, and I admire people who do. I'm just giving you what I think is a kind of common sense approach based upon things I've seen.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it very much, as usual, Patrick.
Oh, you're welcome,
I appreciate all your advice, and I love your show, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Hang in there. It's going to be okay. I really do believe that. It will be okay. Give it some time. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have a line that just opened up. Call now. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Fort Myers, Florida now and speak to Rosalie. Hi, Rosalie.
Hi. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
I need a recommendation of a book of saints. A relative in another state who is going to turn 14 next month. Mm-hmm. Just was confirmed, and I want to send a saint's book. I get the feeling he may not be too scholarly, so that may have an effect on your recommendation.
And 14 years old, right? Boy or girl?
It's a boy, and it'll be next month, 14.
Okay. Well, I've always been partial to Butler's Lives of the Saints. It's a large mm-hmm. volume, but it has so many of the saints, many of the obscure ones, and pretty much all of the major saints. And it's fascinating. Some of the stories are brief. Some are longer. I love the Acts of the Martyrs. So if you were to go to Tan Books, T-A-N, well, I mean, go to your local Catholic bookstore first if you have one handy. But if you don't, I mean, you could try them. Ignatius Press, Tan Books, I think also Sophia Institute Press, those three for sure have Lives of the Saints in the form of Stories of the Martyrs. And I got to tell you, when I was a 14-year-old kid, I loved that stuff. It was heroic and amazing and dramatic, and I really loved those books, and I learned a lot about my Catholic faith as a Ute by reading the Lives of the Saints. So Ignatius Press, Sophia Institute Press, and Tan Books, just check those out online and look for their story or their, I'm sorry, their books on the Lives of the Saints. And you'll find a bunch, and then you can drill down and figure out which one you think would be the best, and then try that.
Okay. I just want to thank you and all of Relevant Radio. You are a lifeline to us Catholics who are hanging into the ark, and I just want to thank you for all that you do, and you're in my prayers every day, all of
thank
Relevant
you,
Radio.
Thank you, Rosalie. Thank you so much.
God bless you.
For all of us here at Relevant Radio, thank you. We're most grateful for them. Now, let me just expand on what I was saying to Rosalie for a minute. For the kiddos, the younger folk, I strongly recommend parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, interested third parties, get the kids Holy Heroes. That's their website, by the way, holyheroes.com. They've got a ton of CDs and just, I mean, it would take me too long to try to catalog everything they've got, but they're very highly produced, high production values, professional voice actors, music background, all kinds of things. By the way, I have no connection whatsoever in any way that benefits me with these people. I know the family that owns the company, and I really do believe in the work they do. And one of the things is Nancy and I have gotten the Holy Heroes and Glory Stories CDs about the saints and things for our children, well, really pretty much our grandchildren now because our kids are all adults. And they're wonderful. And the kids clamor for them. So if you want to teach the little ones from the time they're little about Jesus and Mary and the sacraments and what it means to be a saint and love God, check those things out. You'll find them very helpful. And I just want to underscore, I benefit in no way whatsoever from telling you about this. It's just my service to you. That's all. A public service announcement. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ken now in Port Washington, Wisconsin. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, sir. Yesterday, you had a caller who questioned about the Gideons.
Yeah.
The Gideon Bible.
Yes.
I've got some background on that. Would you mind me giving just like a one-minute spiel?
No, feel free.
You and your listeners will love this. They were founded in Wisconsin in the 1890s in a small town called Boscobel, and there were two businessmen in the lobby, and they found they were both believers, and they said, why don't we have a devotional after dinner? And they decided, why don't we get an organization that will print and distribute Bibles. And since then, they've grown immensely. And I have a friend who's an Army chaplain, and the Army Chaplain Corps, Protestants and Catholics alike, use those pocket New Testaments tremendously. Mm-hmm. The Gideons plants them in hotels, motels, mm-hmm. prisons and jails, hospitals, nursing homes. And I know I was an Army soldier years ago, and they gave us these little New Testaments, and particularly in the back. Now they're New King James, NIV, and so forth. Back then they were the regular King James. But I copied this from the index. Listen to this. For people who are discouraged, afraid, depressed, lonely, sick, losing faith, worried, tempted to do wrong, sorrowful, facing death, weary, da-da-da. So there are quick reference points that people can quickly go to. And I think you mentioned yesterday to the callers that in hotels, there's often strange people and strange circumstances.
Yeah.
And I think people seeing that Bible there or the New Testament, it's an encouragement to Christians and it's a warning to unbelievers. And last comment, then I'll finish and you can take over. I think they're now in over 60 countries, and I know missionaries use them particularly when the wall came down. A lot of them were taking those into the Old East Bloc. So just adding a little word to the topic of the Gideons and what they do, by and large, I think it's very beneficial. And I'll close with, you played the Rocky Raccoon Paul McCartney song yesterday, which was kind of cool. So, hey, thanks for listening to my little spiel here on the
You got it, Ken. Yeah, that's helpful background. Thank you. I didn't know the story about the two guys getting together. As it happens, this ties in with what you were saying, Ken. Somebody, and I really am remiss in not remembering who it is, but almost certainly was a kind listener, who gifted me 3-4 years ago, maybe, one of these pocket Bibles. Well, it was, I believe it was a pocket New Testament from World War II. And this, you know, about the size of a matchbook, size of a box of matches, maybe. And it was in very good condition. I believe it was overseas. It was part of the, you know, the effects of a serviceman who I think had died and somehow fell into his possession, or it was his grandfather or something. So he gave it to me. And I have it as a treasured item in my book collection. And it's very small, but it has, just like you were describing, it's got a list of different life issues: fear, temptation, death, sickness, morale problems, etc. And then you can flip to the sections in the New Testament that speak to those issues. So I have one of those little things, and I'm glad I do, because I just, you know, it's a connection with the fact that there were men over there who were fighting and dying to protect us and to defeat Hitler. And to have that little connection is meaningful to me. Thank you. Let's go to Mike now, listening in Milroy, Minnesota. Hello, Mike. Where is Milroy in relation, say, to the Twin Cities?
Milroy is in the southwest corner of the state.
Okay.
Marshall is a bigger town that's close to Milroy. Marshall is the headquarters of Schwann's, if you ever heard of Schwann's.
Yeah. Yeah, their bakery trucks deliver baked goods all across the land. I know them.
Yes, I'm close to that. Everybody has someone they know who works for Schwann, some relative around here.
Right.
All right, my question. I'm asking how Jesus was tempted, and especially how he was tempted in different ways than us. I've heard that Jesus is tempted in every way that we are, and I don't necessarily dispute that, but I think a lot of our temptation comes from repetitive, chronic sins that keep on coming up and over again, and things that are the same, and that isn't going to happen with Jesus. Never sinned in the first place. And I'm sure he had other temptations because he is God. And I was just wondering about his temptation. I heard you talk about that once other time, and I'd like to hear that again, maybe.
Yeah, happy to. So let me share with you what I believe is the best way to approach this topic. Number one, we know that Jesus was tempted. For example, he was driven into the desert by the Holy Spirit, and he was led there by God to be tempted. So he experienced this, and we see some of it in the incident with Satan, who is saying, turn these stones into bread. Obviously, you're hungry. Let's get some food going. How about it, Jesus? You can do it. So the way I think, the way to understand this issue is that, yes, Jesus was tempted, but the temptations were external to him. And what I mean by that, Mike, is that unlike Jesus, you and I are tempted that way, but we're also tempted in another way. All human beings are. And that is where you stop and think about, I could do that. I could commit that sin. I could, you know, you kind of turn it over in your mind and you imagine what it might be like to do a particular sin. Now, maybe, and hopefully you say, oh, no, I can't do that. I won't do that. And you push the temptation away. Jesus didn't do that. Jesus never did that. Jesus never contemplated and thought about or fantasized or gave some, you know, real consideration of any sort whatsoever to breaking the commandments. Not even once, because Jesus, not only as a divine person is completely incapable of that. But in his humanity, even with the limitations of his humanity, his human will was always perfectly and irrevocably united with the will of God. So in the incarnation, this is, I think, the final part of my answer, Mike. In the incarnation, when God the Son took to himself and united to his divine nature, the human nature in Jesus Christ, there was nothing in that union between the human nature and the divine nature that was in any way at odds or incompatible with his divinity. So extending here to his human will, there was never a moment when in his human will, Jesus wavered and thought about, maybe I'll do that. That's the kind of temptation that we're prone to, but Jesus wasn't. So when we talk about him being tempted, it's always in that first sense where there were efforts made on the part of some, in the case of Satan, to try to tempt him, but he was impervious to that and he never gave it any consideration. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense.
Okay, awesome. Well, this is perfect timing. You're welcome, because I've got to take a break. So we will do that now, and we'll come back. We have some lines open. The number to dial is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. There's a meme floating around that you probably have seen, and maybe you've even sent it to somebody at one time or another. I'll tell you the latest with that meme when I come back from this quick timeout. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, Mean Girl. Not Mean Girl, but Meme Girl. You may remember this one. They call her Disaster Girl. Cyrus, I know you've seen this meme before. I think everybody has. It's this cute little girl who's... She was 4 years old at the time, and she's sort of smirking at the camera.
Everybody knows who you're talking about already.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, they have
They
to.
Know that.
Yeah, the big fire
and this
burning.
Raging fire. this house is completely engulfed in flames. And it's behind her, and she's smirking at the camera. Which,
I wonder
of course,
if she was investigated for arson after that after that photo was taken.
Stephen King wrote a book called Firestarter about a little girl who could do that, could like light people and things on fire. And when I first saw that meme years ago, that's what I thought of.
That's funny.
Can you find that and post that? Because I mean, for people listening,
That'll be super easy. I'll just say meme.
Disaster Girl.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. She's now 21 years old. Her name is Zoe Roth. And she is the little girl in this meme. And she's selling the original picture. And guess how much she sold the picture for? Can you guess? It's more than $10.
Do you want me to guess? I can't tell if these are rhetorical questions.
$473,000.
What? What?
So you're going to go back through your like childhood photo albums and see if you can find anything that you can meme and then sell it for a pretty penny, right?
I might just start driving around looking for disasters and taking pictures of my kids looking back at the camera.
Well, it's been done now. So I don't think anybody
it's
would.
It's too late. It's been
they'll
done.
Say that's derivative.
Yep. And it would be.
Yeah. So she, it's a funny picture. It's a funny and kind of scary picture.
She's 21 now?
Mm-hmm.
Memes are that old?
That meme is.
Wow.
Yeah.
So she's set. She's going to have college paid for. Good for her. Hey, good for her.
Some of the meme people don't work out so well. In fact, I've seen some people like, you know, the funny looking guy wearing the weird sweater and he's smiling. I know you've seen this one too. I mean, it's just one of those.
That's not ringing a bell.
Oh, it would. I would show it to you and you would recognize it. But anyway, just a little bit on this story here. This is from New York Post. So they referred to this, or she referred to this, to the picture, saying, in 2005, my dad took a picture of me standing in front of a house fire. I was standing there looking evil, as if I had started the fire. But oh my gosh, no, I didn't. So She sold it to a collector known simply as @3fmusic. This is according to the Daily Mail. And they think it might be a sheikh in Dubai somewhere who bought it. The owner has since anonymously released a statement saying, "Our management team is always in cooperation with some highly knowledgeable and experienced art advisors who believe that we must grow with technological movements that help us not only promote our business, but also support artists in the art market," whatever that means. But for her, it means $473,000 in the bank before taxes, of course. So there's that. Just a little empty calorie to brighten your day, Cyrus. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to West Bend, Wisconsin, and talk to Jenny. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I had a conversation with someone yesterday that I need your help. I wish I could have pulled you right out of my pocket.
Pocket Pat.
Was saying that, you know, God knows everything. God has a plan. Mm-hmm. And so more or less she was saying, why should we pray? Why should we bother praying? Because we're not going to change God's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how to respond to that.
This is a mysterious issue that we can know some things about. And we know this, for example, Jesus said, ask your Father in heaven for the things that you need. You know, he already knows what you need, but he delights in you asking him. And he likes to give good things to you when you ask him. So we know from Jesus himself that we should pray. So I fear that the person who told you this is maybe falling into one of two traps. One trap would be a kind of laziness trap that says, well, I'm not going to exert myself to really do anything or pray or anything because God's already got it pre-programmed, so it doesn't really matter what I do. That's false. The other kind of trap would be a trap of despair, which would be to say, you know, I would like to be able to make something happen, but I can't because it's all pre-programmed and my hands are tied. I can't really do anything. That's also false. So the answer to the question is providence. And this term that St. Thomas Aquinas used in his explanation of things like, how do we account for chance? How do we account for what seems like coincidence and luck and things like that? They seem like they're random and non-caused things that just happen, synchronicity, etc. So what St. Thomas said is no. He says that all of this is part of God's providence, but God's providence still respects our freedom. And so God's plan for your happiness and mine is unfolding all the time. And all kinds of things happen that sometimes that seem meaningless, or we see meaning in them, maybe. It could seem like luck or chance. But ultimately, his point is that this is God's plan for salvation, and the plan will be different depending upon how you respond to it. So let's take the most basic example, Jenny. Okay, think about this. Jesus said, for God so loved the world that whoever would believe in him, that he sent his only son, that whoever would believe in him would not perish but have eternal life. So that's God's plan of salvation. That's his providence for the whole world. He would like everybody to be saved. Now, obviously, not everybody is saved. So God is extending this plan of happiness. Some people are willing to accept it, and by his grace, they're empowered to do so and to cooperate it. Others reject it. So it's not like, you know, you're changing God's mind per se, but in the case of somebody who accepts God's free gift of salvation, that person now enjoys the plan the way God intended it for that person. And the person who says no, he has to deal with the after effects of something that God didn't intend for him, but he gets that because that's what he chose. That's what he said yes to, and he said, of course, no to God. So even just at that basic level, we can see that you're not pre-programmed. The people who go to heaven are not forced there. They're predestined for heaven, true, but they're not forced to go there, nor are the people who are damned forced to be damned. That gift of grace, that invitation to happiness is given by God to everybody. So there you can catch a glimpse, I hope anyway, you can catch a glimpse of how, you know, if you couldn't really pray, if you couldn't say, Lord, I'm sorry, please forgive me, nobody could be saved. Jesus said, unless you repent, you too will all perish. But if it's impossible that you could do anything that would change the outcome, well, then nobody could ever be saved because we all have to repent. We all have to accept this gift of grace. And if that weren't possible, then the whole, everything about Christianity and everything about what Jesus said would be nullified. And obviously, that's not the case. Does that make sense? I mean, do you see a glimmer there of what I'm talking about?
Oh, it makes total sense. Yes. Thank you very much. I'm going to have to re-listen to this because that was a lot of a lot of good response that I want to be able to, you know, next time I talk to her, share with her as well.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe you can play this link from this part of the program for her.
Yeah, I'll try because I'm not that great with technology, but I can ask someone to help me figure it out. The scripture passage that you first started out with, as far as
believing
the
in Jesus,
Father said, ask what you ask. You know, I'm weird. I shouldn't be able to know how to look that up, but where in the Bible would I find
that? There are countless places. So how about this? Matthew chapter 7, beginning in verse 7, Jesus says, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks, to him it will be opened. Or which one of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or which of you, if his son asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? Et cetera, et cetera.
Perfect. Matthew 7:7. Got it.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm glad we could talk about this. It's an important topic, and it deserves even more attention. Thank you. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. You can call now. We'll get you on the air. I think we do have time before we have to take a break. So let's go to John next, listening in Rhode Island. Hi, John.
Hi, Patrick. Patrick, has recent carbon dating been done on the shroud that indicate it goes back to Jesus' time? Do you know?
I believe so, yeah. There was some carbon dating that had been done in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was botched because they carbon dated a patch as opposed to the actual linen cloth itself, and the patch was from medieval times. But if you contact the Shroud Center in Southern California, that might be their website. Maybe Cyrus can look it up. I think it's shroudcenter.org. There's one that's in Southern California. It's near... where is it near? Well, it's near Mission Viejo, and they have up-to-the-minute research information that's available. So if you want to get, like, when was the next carbon dating done and who did it and where was it done, they would have all that information.
Okay. My second question is, to my knowledge, the evidence seems to be overwhelming. Why hasn't the church declared it a relic?
Well, I mean, I don't know that the church hasn't declared it a relic because, after all, it is in, I believe it's in the cathedral in Turin, Italy, if I'm not mistaken. And I believe that there is an occasional opportunity for people to see this when it's brought out and shown publicly. The Shroud Center would have those details as well. But it has a long and storied pedigree in the history of the church as being venerated as a relic. If you're asking why hasn't the church, officially authenticated it as being this is the burial cloth of Jesus, I don't think the church would ever do that because, you know, the question would be, well, what if something were to emerge that would falsify that? That would be a bad situation for the church to be in. So I think the church is content to say, let's see what science says, and scientists are baffled by this, and the imagery that exists in this shroud, you probably have seen some of these studies. It's a photographic image. It's a negative image. It's a three-dimensional image. It's an image that can't be accounted for. How did this get on this fabric? There's no way to explain some of these anomalies. And I think, if I had to guess, I think the church is content to simply let science try its hardest to explain it. And then, in the absence of any scientific explanation, say, well, you know, very possibly is what it appears to be, and kind of leave it at that.
I see. Okay. It does seem to capture the moment of the resurrection. I mean, the image seems to have gotten on it through almost supernatural means, again, that science cannot explain.
Yeah.
And it seems to have captured the moment of the resurrection, but
it does, yes.
My opinion, I suppose.
Yeah, it sure does.
Okay, thank you.
During the break, I'm going to find the Shroud Center in Southern California, and I will announce that so that you can check it out and see what they have on that. But yeah, it's quite fascinating. They actually have a place you can go. And it has life-sized photographic reproductions of it. There's an immense amount of information that's available, and it's open to the public. Well, COVID. So I don't know if COVID has changed that, but under ordinary circumstances, if you ever want to make a road trip from Rhode Island to California, that could be a place you could go, John. Thank you. Hey, I've got to take another break, but we'll do that quickly and come back to more of your phone calls. The number again is 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Well, take some advice, Pilgrim.
Follow Patrick on Twitter, at Patrick Madrid.
Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your
real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We can work it out.
Great song.
We can work it out.
Welcome back, 888-914-9149. We'll go straight to the phones. Linda in Austin, it's good to have you on the program.
Good morning, Patrick.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Quick question. In 1 Samuel, we're studying in our Bible study the book of Samuel, and we're in 1 Samuel, and particularly chapter 20, verse 30, when Jonathan and David deceive Saul.
Mm-hmm.
And manipulate him, and there's many other lies that are going on, you know, in mm-hmm. that time to protect David and protect Jonathan mm-hmm. from Saul. And the commentary was that, or the priest that gave the commentary was that there's no excuse for a lie whatsoever. But he didn't elaborate on that. And I guess what I'm asking mm-hmm. you not to, for instance, people that are being persecuted and you're hiding somebody in your house and the Gestapo comes and says, I want them, you know,
mm-hmm.
Are you supposed to turn them over? It's a moral, theological question, I suppose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you help me on that?
I'll try. Yeah, I'll try. So the first thing to remember is that in the Bible, you're seeing the stories of things, how they were and people, how they acted. So this story and other stories like it are not intended to say, hey, look, do what David did. It's to say, hey, look, this is what David did. And then we can draw conclusions on that basis. So it's not a prescription for behavior. It's a description of behavior. In 2 Samuel, we see quite a bit more of King David and as he was rehabilitated. But one of the things that he did was he seduced a married woman, Bathsheba. He fathered a child with her out of wedlock, and then he had her husband murdered. So you get that whole description. Or the drunkenness of Noah, when his daughters got him drunk on wine and some bad things happened. And there are plenty of stories like that throughout the Old Testament. And they're not intended to say, hey, do this, but rather look at what they did, look at what happened. And then in some cases, you want to say, well, I definitely don't want to do that. I want to see that as a cautionary tale. But with regard to your moral question of lying, strictly speaking, the church has always said, St. Thomas, St. Augustine, and others have said that lying is always a sin. But there's also, the church recognizes that sometimes you find yourself in what seems to be an intolerable situation where you seem to only have two choices, and both of them involve doing something that would be wrong. So how do you get through this if the only options you seem to have involve something that's wrong? So on the one hand, taking the case that you used, kind of the classic scenario with Jews hiding in the attic and the Nazis bang on the front door and say, are you hiding any Jews? Now, if you say No, you can save their lives, but you've just lied to do that. Now, if you say yes, mm-hmm. you haven't lied, but now you've got innocent people who are going to be dragged away and killed. So it's an intolerable situation to try to say, you know, I either won't do anything or I'll do one or the other, because the one option of saying, yes, there are Jews hiding in the attic, we rebel against the idea of sending those innocent people to their deaths just so that you wouldn't say a lie. And what St. Thomas says is you should always tell the truth. But I think we see that there are situations where it becomes practically impossible to do that if you know that the alternative is something far worse, or to use the phrase, the lesser of two evils. Now, I'm speaking about this as sort of a practical, in the moment, the way people experience it, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to draw out strict theological premises here. We should always strive to avoid anything that would involve deception. But I mean, what if you went to somebody's home for dinner and the food was horrible? And you knew that if they said, well, how did you like the food? And if you said the honest truth, well, I didn't like it, it was horrible. You could really hurt that person. So you say something innocuous like, oh, it was delicious, thank you. That's a lie. But yeah. I think under the circumstances, you're not really morally obligated to brutalize somebody with the truth. And I don't think that that would rise to the level of a sin to say, oh, it was delicious, even though it really wasn't. Now, there are other aspects to this, Linda. There's what's called mental reservation, and I'm not suggesting that, but it is a technique that some people will use or employ to try to lie without lying. And what that means is you can say something as an answer to a question in a way that you know the other person will misunderstand. And you're intentionally misleading the person, but in your mental reservation, you're saying to yourself, but I don't really mean it in that sense. I don't really mean it in the way that I know he's going to understand it. But I'll say that knowing that I'm misleading him, but my mental reservation is, but I don't really mean that. So that's a trick. That's a technique or a ploy. I don't endorse it, but it's another part of the conversation. If you were to read the literature, people would bring that up because that was a proposal for this. So I guess I can leave it at that, Linda. There's a lot more to it. But if you want to get it straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak, I would just go to the Catechism. And in the section dealing with the Ten Commandments, just read the section on lying. And it lays it out.
Very good. Very good. Thank you so much, Patrick. God
You're welcome,
bless you,
Linda,
and your ministry.
Thank you. Great to talk to you. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Southern California and talk to Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Patrick. This is Dave from the Santiago Retreat Center.
Yes.
We met a couple years ago when you were out there.
I remember.
And this is providential. I get in my car to go to Mass this morning at the Santiago Retreat Center, and there I hear this call about the Shroud Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, there's things happening, Patrick. Somebody donated a bundle of money to the retreat center, and there's going to be a huge renovation. It's going to be a major retreat center. And the
Wonderful.
Shroud Center of Southern California, as you know, is right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. We're doing presentations, and we're knocking the socks off of people. This thing is just amazing. And
it is. Now, I've been there, as you know, Dave. I want to let people understand the context here. And I didn't know you were going to call in. But I went to the Shroud Center. And by the way, I promised people I would tell them the address. So it's shroudcenter.com. And all the things that I described are there on the website. But I was there and I saw a presentation. I believe you gave the presentation, you and another gentleman. And there was a great deal that I learned just being there at the Shroud Center that day. And I've recommended it to a number of people since then. I think it's just a tremendous resource. And I'm happy to hear that things are expanding.
We are doing presentations regularly. We set groups up. They contact the retreat center. This is fantastic for kids. Because we present it not as a scientific project, but as a story. We tell the story of the Shroud from John 20 through Edessa, through Constantinople, the whole history of it. And then we get into the science of it. And you're right, your caller was right. The science is telling us that the image was created in this monstrous burst of light.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Dave, I have a question for you. The question that the caller asked, I didn't have an answer for, and that was, since the earlier attempt at carbon dating that was faulty because it carbon dated a patch as opposed to the linen itself, have there been other carbon dating tests performed? And if so, what have they produced?
Giulio Fonti of Padua, University of Padua, did a mechanical and I don't remember the term of it, a mechanical time analysis of it, looking at the fibers and the tensile strength of the fibers, and it dated it prior to the Middle Ages. Our Father Spitzer's on our board, Manuela Marinelli, Paolo de la Saro.
These are names other than Father Spitzer. Nobody will know who those people are, Dave. I've got to press on, but just really quickly for people who are interested in going to the Shroud Center, you mentioned the Santiago Retreat Center. Most people probably won't know where that is. Can you just give a quick way for people to find out how to get
Silverado,
there?
Yeah. We're in Silverado Canyon, just a little bit south of where Irvine Lake is in Silverado Canyon, just over the hill from the new Norbertine Abbey.
Okay.
And yeah, we're doing presentations, and the story is amazing.
Yeah, I agree. It is quite an amazing thing. I was very impressed when I was there. Dave, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it very much. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Will in Nashville. Hi, Will.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hey,
sure.
I just preface my comments by saying I'm a Christian. I am a Protestant, not a Catholic. You and I would disagree on some things, Patrick, but we would agree on many others as well. For instance, I do enjoy the fullness of my salvation. Thank you very much. But I really liked your answer on predestination a few minutes ago. You brought that word into the conversation. I know, you know many Protestants, and I know Catholics as well, who believe that predestination simply means that a person before they are born, going back to before this world was created, that God had a certain segment of people who he was going to save or were saved, and others who were not. And I just don't believe that. In my research, the word predestination in the Bible, when it's used talking about salvation, a better translation is planned or designed. You know, obviously God's plan is for all of us to come to saving grace, though we won't, and he has designed us to do as such. But I do not believe the concept or the principle that predestination simply means a person, it's already predestined before they're born. They really don't have any choice in it. You tell me if that kind of goes along with, I guess, your view in the Catholic view.
It does, yeah, and fair enough on the point that you're making. The Catholic Church believes in predestination because, of course, the Bible teaches it. Romans chapter 8 would be the locus classicus for that. But we certainly don't understand predestination in the way that might be familiar to you if you were talking to a Calvinist, and certainly not double predestination, which would make God into a moral monster if that were the case. So the word predestination, I use it because the Bible uses it. And I refer to it in the sense that St. Paul speaks about it in Romans chapter 8. But there are all sorts of connotations, especially within the Protestant world, because it's not really a term you hear Catholics talking about too much. But within the Protestant world, there are all sorts of connotations that I think you might be reacting to that I don't necessarily hold. In fact, I would reject some of those notions about predestination myself. So you and I might be far closer on this issue than you might imagine.
No, I think we are. I think we're probably definitely within the same vein here. You know, obviously Protestants, you have the Calvinist view, you have the Arminian view, and something in between as well. I just don't believe that the Bible teaches, though, what the Calvinist view of predestination. I would agree.
I would agree with that. Now, the Calvinists will get really hot when you say that, because they think that's gospel.
Oh, sure they do. Yeah. Sure they do. I have good friends, good Christian brothers and sisters who believe that. Now, I've never been able, Patrick, to reconcile free will versus the Calvinist view of predestination. I just don't think it's possible. But I just thought it was very interesting that you mentioned the word predestination as you were talking to the lady, and that's exactly where I thought you were going as you were doing that. And I really liked your answer.
I'm glad. Thank you.
We'd be very much in agreement on that.
But let me offer you a resource that you might find interesting. Well, it's called Predestination, the Meaning of Predestination in Scripture and the Church. It was written by a Catholic scholar. Father Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange. Don't let the last name throw you. It's just a long French name. But that book just digs into Scripture, and it presents, this is what the Catholic Church teaches about predestination. And if you really wanted a deeper analysis of what the Catholic Church teaches on that, that would be a great place to start.
Well, listen, I appreciate that, and thanks so much for your time, and you have a fine day.
Thank you, Will. Nice to chat with you. Let's see. Ah, look at that. Perfect timing. As God's providence unfolds all around us, right? 888-914-9149 is the number to call. You can call now. We'll get you on the air. 888-914-9149. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. And I will be right back right after this.
Good morning. Sunday morning.